Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the program. I am your host, Chris George Zuger, and you have entered the Den of Lore for what is a bonus episode specifically designed to whet your appetites for the end of the month, One Year Spectacular. We have none other than the great Robert Pavall joining us on September 29th for a live show. And to get you guys all ready for it, we have a special one-hour interview with none other than the man himself that was I had conducted with him at the beginning of July, just before the Jaw Symposium, to raise money for John Anthony West. And we got to talking, and I have to say it was a fantastic enough of an interview that not only did we want to include it on the Jaw Symposium, but also include it on the Den of Lore bonus episode list. This does not send us out of sync, thankfully, so he will still be on for episode 60. I believe we're going to be doing the show sometime around 6 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, but please do check back to the YouTube channel for the proper times. And a special thanks goes out to all of our patrons, specifically our masters, who help us keep the show on the air. Special thanks goes out to Antonio Martinez, Mark Catalano, Frederick Johnson, Kevin Fothy, Jared Thompson, Mrs. Fox, Roses, Wayne, Joshua, Matic, Ellen McCurdy, and to our other patrons, Hobby, Venice from Magical Egypt, Anthony, Derry, Sentient, Atlanticouche, Dean, and Michael Eckhoff. You guys are the reason we keep the show on the air every single week. You help us pay for things like the web server, the email account monthly bills, the internet that goes to the actual computer, which allows us to do our web streams, and anything that is show related in terms of expenses. You guys ensure that we can pay those bills month to month, and that we can stay revenue neutral with my wife literally 3 months from right now about to give birth to our first. It is much appreciated, and I am grateful for all of you for your continued support. So please do enjoy the interview, and I will see you all on September 29th.
I'd heard of him, but I was totally oblivious to what John West and Robert Schock were doing in Egypt, amazingly. But I was there at the time they were investigating the Sphinx in 91 and 93. But for some reason, we didn't cross paths. And frankly, the Sphinx was not at all in my line of sight, if that's the right word. I was very focused on the astronomy of the pyramids of Giza, and I was going full blast to present this both in a book form. So I was writing a book at the time, between 92 and 93, and I was also doing a BBC documentary at the time. So I was very, very taken by this, by just the pyramids, and the Sphinx for some reason was not something that that I was involved with at all. I didn't see it how it fitted at all in this this scheme, in this correlation theory that I was developing. Mm-hmm. However, I'll cut a long story short as usual, but I got to meet Hancock, let me get this right, late in 93. And he put me in touch with John West and said, look, there's this guy with a Boston professor, Robert Schock. They're both looking at the Sphinx. They say that it's much older. Now, I got very intrigued by this because in my book, The Orion Mystery, although I didn't speak about the Sphinx at all, or very much in passing, I can't remember offhand now, I had shown that the layout of the Giza pyramids were reflecting on the ground an image of the sky of Orion's belt in 10,500 BC. And because now John West and Robert Schoch were claiming a much older Sphinx, I got intrigued. And so let's look at this. I met John. He was staying at his sister's at the time in upstate New York. And I remember I decided to specifically go and see him. I took a trip to the States. I'm not too sure if I was on a visit to see my publishers, but definitely on my agenda was to meet John West. And I remember renting a car. I was with Adrian Gilbert, my co-author. And we drove all the way to upstate New York in White Plains. That's right. I'm trying to remember the name. And as we approached, I'll never forget this moment. It's one of these moments because as we approached, I parked the car. It was a very woody sort of place, lovely trees, and they had this lovely house. And I had seen John on television, and he was there. I think they were doing a barbecue, and I walked into the garden, into the place, and he looked at me, and I approached him, and I thought, let me do a sort of Stanley meets Livingston sort of thing. So jokingly, I said, John West, I presume. And he sort of took the joke, and that's how we shook hands and we met the first time. And what followed, of course, is Hancock and I writing The Message of the Sphinx, where I developed where I realized that it was in alignment with the Sphinx that correlated with the constellation of Leo at the same time that the pyramids correlated with Orion's belt in 10,500 BC. So suddenly the whole thing merged together. So that's the background of all this. You'll have to sort of press my pause button, by the way, Chris, if you want to.
It's not a problem. The whole purpose of this is to, again, to celebrate John Anthony West and to ensure that...
Absolutely. I mean, look, let me say this. You know, John is the eldest in the fullest sense of the word. I mean, John's been dragging his heels at the Giza Necropolis and in this Egyptian mysteries long before I got in. We know his story that started way back in the 60s, I think, on the island of Ibiza, when he got involved with the Schwalo de Lubitz work. I was definitely not in this business at all. So I see John as the white herb of our gang. I think I'm Doc Halliday. And that's how I see John. I mean, John is the man, and I've always seen him as a senior to me. I, like everybody else, I adore his sense of humor, his cynical, cutting sense of humor, and he's a legend. I mean, he's he's the last of a breed. He's the last of a breed, you know, one of these adventurous scholar come couldn't give a damn about what anybody thinks, wants to sort of really I mean, one thing I like about John is that he generally, maybe the word generally is correct, but he's deeply against this stuck-up Egyptological community that, and he's done a very good job out of exposing their bias and their blockages. He's the man, you know, really for what the public needed. You know, the whole thing blew up on the big scene when he and John West brought out this Age of the Sphinx, but particularly when they did the Mystery of the Sphinx documentary. You know, suddenly everybody was around the world was looking at this Giza mm-hmm. mysteries, and I will not hide it. It did a lot of it brought a lot of attention to what I was doing. So, having said this, it's an amazing honor for me to have twice written about the Sphinx, where the first time with the Graham Hancock Mysteries of the Sphinx. I'm trying to find the book here. can I move a bit here?
Of course.
Yeah, hold on. should have prepared for this, but the best interviewers are unprepared. Isn't that right, Chris?
You know, our last interview, I think, hit about 3,000 views and over 75,000 downloads.
Well, there you are, Keeper of Genesis. This is the original hardback. In America, it was titled Message of the Sphinx, a book which I'm very, very proud of, not least because it was a number one bestseller on the Sunday Times listing. Mm-hmm. Only Sunday Times number one bestseller. It's the Wimbledon. It's the Wimbledon of books. So I'm very proud of this. But we have devoted a whole chapter on John. But there we go again. Little did I know that I would get to write a book with Robert Schock, who is really... Schock is really the partner of John. You know, let's call a spade a spade. I mean, it's very difficult to say Robert Schock without saying John West, and saying John West without Robert Schock. I mean, it became a team, and the sort of Starsky and Hutch type of team, and they did so well together. Schock being the academic, West being West being West. But here am I, many, many years later, in fact, 23 years later, my God, with Robert Schock, having written Origins of the Sphinx. And again, I mean, not only much of what we write is devoted, or certainly what Schock writes is devoted to John West, but there's a wonderful dedication. Normally, I dedicate these books to my wife, and I'm sure Robert the same. But this time, okay, here it is. I think I better read it. It says, we dedicate this book to our friend and colleague, John Anthony West, a courageous soul. That's it, John, a courageous soul. He guts, you know. It's far hard for people who haven't been involved with this to realize how much courage and resistance you need to bring a new original idea, especially something that will topple the apple cart of history, like the Age of the Sphinx, and hold on it for 25 years. And John's done that. I mean, he will go down in history as the man, as the Sphinx man. So there we are. In Origins of the Sphinx, Schock reviews again all this adventure he had with West. There's wonderful pictures with him and West at the origins of this affair. He expands, of course. We both expand on the arguments, which I hope John will be pleased, because John's initial hunch, that the Sphinx was much older, his very perceptive approach to bringing an academic like Schock to bring the matter to attention, as he did, and the resistance that he had through the years. I mean, boy, I'm sure he's heard it from everybody. Is paying off. It's paying off because the result of all this is not only the strong geological arguments that Schock and West brought in the 90s, but also, of course, the astronomy that I brought with Hancock, that puts two hard sciences on the table here for the opposition to look at, for the Orthodox establishment to look at. What we've done in this book, and certainly what I've done both with the astronomy and the textual material, is to approach the problem in reverse. I call this reverse engineering. Having argued astronomically and geologically that the Sphinx is a much older edifice, then one would assume that this knowledge was known to the ancient Egyptians themselves. And now Egyptologists have... Chris, are you still there?
I'm still here. I'm listening. I'm letting you let the magic happen.
Okay. Well, my approach this time was to say, first of all, let's clear all the issues. Astronomically, Robert Schock dealt with the geology, but I looked into matters that we hadn't looked into details before. A whole chapter is devoted, for example, on the so-called Sphinx Stela, where the so-called, well, the name or part of the name of King Khafre is on it, and this was regarded as a smoking gun evidence by the Egyptologist that Khafre was responsible for the Sphinx, Khafre of the Fourth Dynasty. But I've devoted a whole chapter there to show that it is disingenuous by the part of Egyptologists to use this as a smoking gun. It isn't a smoking gun at all. It doesn't prove one way or the other. So these are the approaches I've had. But my main concern was to say, look, if we're right about this, then the Egyptians themselves must know this truth, and they must have conserved this knowledge throughout their civilization. Now, one of the strong pieces of argument is the Stela, which I just mentioned, which is in the breast of the Sphinx, which makes a statement. Now, this Stela was put there by Thutmose IV around 1400 BC or so, which is about 1,000 years after the date that Egyptologists allocate to the Sphinx. But nonetheless, here is a pharaoh stating that this is the place of the beginning. He uses the words first time in ancient Egyptian, Zep Tepi, literally first time. Now, I have shown that Zep Tepi, astronomically, must be 10,500 BC. I don't want to go through the whole mechanics of this, but it's again in this book, Origins of the Sphinx, and of course, in Keeper of Genesis, Message of the Sphinx. But I needed something more, and in fact, of a later date. And here is the interesting part of this new what I call reverse engineering, is to start from the top. Say, okay, I'll go to one of the late temples, because we know that the temple of Horus at Edfu speaks of the origins of the Egyptian civilization. Even though Egyptologists say it's mythology and, you know, the usual thing. I had not taken such deep interest in this. I knew of these texts. I knew quite a lot about them, but I hadn't gone through the nitty-gritties. And there's two things that came out in this research that I did during the writing of this book. One is that the texts are categoric about a group of people that came. They call them the sages, they call them the wise men, they call them the divinities, they call them the builders, but they brought along a book. And I got very interested, you know, why would they bring a book? And this book, and we have the title of it, we don't have the book, we have no idea what happened to it, but this book is titled, we're told this at the Edfu Temple several times, by the way. It's titled The Specification of the Primordial Mounds. And the word mounds is very interesting, because we know that the pyramids are built, most of the pyramids, particularly those at Giza, are built on mounds. So I thought, that is interesting. Let me look at this.
Now, to be able to interject very quickly, and this is coming from a very good friend of yours, Mr. David Roll, and he and I discussed this at one point. and he'd stated that the mounds themselves had already been there. Is this?
Of course, yeah. Of course, yes. The mounds are natural mounds, and they've been there since millions of years. I think what he meant, and what Robert Schork also agrees, is that, for example, the Great Pyramid is built on not just on a mound, but part of the mound is actually inside the lower part of the Great Pyramid. The pyramid is literally has the core, the summit of this mound, literally in its core, about 12 meters. So, in the book, this has been argued before. In fact, I had brought this matter up with the late Professor Edwards, Sir Ivan Edwards, many, many years ago, that it doesn't make sense at all to put a monument such as the Great Pyramid, you know, you're talking about a 6-million-ton edifice, on a mound, and leaving the core of this mound cutting into your substructure. This is totally mad. It's totally against any engineering principle. Now, Egyptologists who have no idea about proper engineering say, well, they wanted to save on labor, so they use part of the mound, you know, as a core. And that's ridiculous, because any engineer will tell you that if you're going to put a building, any building, let alone a 6-million-ton footprint like the Great Pyramid, you want the ground to be absolutely level, perfectly level. And the reason for this is very obvious. You want the weight to be distributed evenly on a flat surface, so that there is no movement or risk of settlement and subsidence.
It would be the equivalent of, let's say, balancing a soda can on one's knee. It's very unstable. Mm-hmm. Eventually,
Let me put it this way. It would be like, I don't know. I mean, I could give you many examples, but in engineering, the first thing we do is we level the site. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is number one, rule number one. You know, if you're going to put a building, you want the site level. And if the site isn't level, we're going to use a special technique of foundations and have the building either on pillars or on a floating foundation. But there are many, many ways to do this. But having said this, it means that the architects and whoever commissioned this building wanted it to be there. They took the risk. So the question is, what was so important about this mound? And again, we discuss it quite extensively in the book, but I've discussed it even more controversially in a book I've written with Professor Chandra Vikramasinghe, which will come out in December. Mm-hmm. Because I don't want to go into too much. I think we talked about this on my last interview, but the location of this mound and the reason probably to put the pyramid there is that it has a very, very important significance geographically. It gives us a very precise coordinates that when you interpret this coordinate, you come up with a very, very weird conclusion. But let me just leave this for now. Anyway, the point is this. David Roll is absolutely correct. The mounds have been there a long time, and we're dealing with several mounds. We know that there was a mound at the Temple of Heliopolis. Indeed, this mound was considered the most sacred place, the place of creation. Mm-hmm. In fact, all these mounds were considered the place of creation. And therefore, what the texts are saying in the Edfu temple, which is of the late period, of the Ptolemaic period, is correct. Is correct. It's remembering, if you like, that there were these mounds and that they served as the location of what they called the original temples, which seem to be the pyramids. Having said this, I looked more in the texts and I found a date. There is a date that something took place at this Zeptepi time, at this beginning, which I date to 10,500 BC, which they give us a calendrical date. They tell us it happened on the first day of the fifth month. They call this the first day of the month of Tibi. And when you, again, I don't want to let out too much for the spoiling the fun of reading this book, But when you realize what this date means. Now, what they tell us happened is that there was a great battle where the Horus, divine man god, defeats his opponent, Seth, the counterpart, the evil counterpart. And from that victory, he becomes the first king of Egypt at this beginning of time. Egyptologists again say this is just mythology, and you know, we can't take it as history. So my hunt, if you like, was to say, okay, if this date has an historical meaning, now we know that the Sphinx is called Horus, Horus of the Horizon, mm-hmm. the name of this original king. And every subsequent pharaoh took the name of Horus. But here is the original Horus claiming a date of his coronation, if you like, the day that he became king of Egypt, the very first king of Egypt. Mm-hmm. We must find it at Giza. And more specifically, we must find that date at the Sphinx. If we find that date of the first of Tibi, of the first of the fifth month at 10,500 BC, then that locks it for me. That means that the remembrance of the Sphinx being there since the beginning of time has survived throughout the pharaonic period and written in stone, literally. And well, not to let the cat out of the bag, as we say, the date has been found, and it's all detailed and nicely explained in here. So that's it. As far as I'm concerned, the Egyptologists can huff and puff on this matter, and it all is because of John West. I really do not think that I would have been involved with looking for an older Sphinx without John West's amazing epiphany. You know, he mm-hmm. it's one of those strange things that happens to writers. You know, he picked up a phrase in a book, and the whole adventure started.
I believe I understand exactly where you're coming from. I think it was the last discussion I had with Laird, and I think it was 3 a.m, and I typed out, I'm like, you're on, from what I can understand, it's possible you're on the right track. Just, you know, keep going. Because even for myself, I don't have, and for a lot of people who may be in interested in this field, interested in looking at our history in a much different manner than what's been told to us throughout modern times by people who claim to be experts but don't know the whole story, we may not have the same level of experience as researchers such as yourself, or the same academic background as Dr. Robert Schock, or the ability just to think outside the box like John Anthony West, or have the eloquence of Graham Hancock. But, you know, we have our own experiences that can sometimes lead to a piece, and, you know, sometimes we can just get into our heads. But the notion of...
You know, it's... I call it the apple, the proverbial apple, you know, the story of Newton, the apple falls on his head. There are people, and I think we're all like that, but there are people who take it to the next step. I mean, we all will have an apple falling on our heads, metaphorically. I mean, my apple was looking at the picture of the pyramids in the wall of on a wall inside the Cairo Museum, and that's it. You know, I asked the question, why is there an offset in this ground plan? But what John did, and I suppose what Graham did, and Schock and myself, is that we could have left it there. We could have said, listen, it's none of my business. I'm not an Egyptologist. I'm not an archaeologist. You know, in fact, I was a construction engineer at the time. And okay, fine. I mean, I'll write a letter and say I've noticed this, and which I did. I wrote a couple of letters to some Egyptologist, Professor Edwards, one of them. And I can tell you, I could have been totally sidetracked and, in fact, discouraged, because I got many replies saying, mind your own business, and this is nothing to do. I mean, we'll take care of this, you know. We're Egyptologists. And, I even had a Swiss Egyptologist telling me, be a good engineer and forget about it. So, and I could have. I mean, you know, frankly, I was doing very well in my engineering career. But it kind of bugged me. I didn't know this kind of profession. I mean, I would have thought that they would have been very interested. They would have given me encouragement. But it was quite the opposite. I did get encouragement from Sir Ivan Edwards, thank goodness. I mean, he said, look, this is very interesting, and why don't you publish it? And that's it. I became, I suppose, obsessed with this. And I suppose the same thing with John West. John West saw a phrase in a book that thousands of people had seen. Mm-hmm. I mean, the books of Schwarer de Lubitz were read, certainly in France, they were read by thousands and thousands of people, academics, historians, engineers. It's just one of those things. They may have noticed that the phrase, you know, that the, I can't remember verbatim, but that the Sphinx had water erosion and hence it must be older. But they just didn't do anything about it. John is one of those guys, you know, that the apple fell on his head and he just said, I'm going to take it, whatever it takes me. And boy, did he take it. I mean, you know, here we are 35 years later. And the books are still being written about this, arguments, discussions, conferences, TV documentaries, you know. Kudos to a man like that, you know. And, you know, it's these kind of individuals that fascinate me. And I don't want to speak about myself, but I see myself a bit like John, is that I'm happy that I did it, you know. I'm happy that, you know, we took it all the way, as we say. I read a very nice quote, apparently attributed to the Buddha. And again, I can't say it verbatim because I can't remember it exactly, but it went something like, it isn't, I think he didn't use, I think he used the word sin, but I can't remember. He said, it isn't a sin to see something out of the ordinary, but not to pursue it, not to do it, is the sin, is the mistake. I don't know if you use mistake. I'll get to the quote a bit later. I've got it written somewhere. But that is it. That is it. You know, that I if I'm to give advice, and I do this to my children, although they don't listen to me much these days, but is take it. Go all the way with it. You might be wrong, but people will respect you for taking it all the way, so that it's settled once and for all. And I think in John's case, regarding the Sphinx, it will be settled in his favor. His intuitive epiphany that he had while he read this book of Schwarer de Lubitz will mark history, has made a lot of people seriously think about Egyptian civilization and therefore world civilization having not only an older origin, but a greater pedigree. I mean, how wonderful this is to see ourselves in that manner. You know that.
Well, there are two quotes that are very applicable, and one is actually from John Anthony West. The first one is a favorite of mine, which is from Edmund Burke, and very many people may know it, which is, the only thing necessary for the triumph of evil is for good men to do nothing. And one of the greatest evils is willful ignorance, or the ability for us to not look at a problem or look at something to gain greater knowledge or greater perspective or greater understanding. It's existing in life with blinders on. That to me is one of the greatest evils, and because it is a certain amount of apathy, and John did not have that in spades, and it leads very well into his next quote, which is, few things in the world are more predictable than the reaction of conventional minds to unconventional ideas, which
I
is
know that one. Sorry,
from John Anthony West. That is one of the most inspirational quotes in terms of people who think differently and who are the type of individual who they know that they're going to get scorn, or they're going to get blowback, or they're going to be shouted down, but they think that they are right and they can logically think through a problem and demonstrate that problem using facts and logic. And
yeah, I mean, yeah, sorry.
Oh, no, continue.
No, I was going to say, well, another thing, I don't know if it's John who said it, but he certainly said it during a conference at the beginning when if I recall well, they were presenting the arguments of an older Sphinx, and an Egyptologist stood up. It might have been Mark Lehner, I'm not sure. But he said, there isn't one single Egyptologist who agrees with you. And I think John said, truth is not democratic. You don't vote on something that is true. You know, it's either true or not. No, I think one of the things that has to be pointed out, and hence why I admire John and people like him, is that he was not intimidated whatsoever by academics, by experts, by people who had a standing in their profession. You know, he just said what he had to say, and he stood by it. And if there's been anything that I took as an example from him, is this. I mean, I was in a profession, a construction profession, where the line of authority was greatly respected. You know, we had the CEO, then we had the vice presidents and all this business. And he made me realize, there's somebody else, believe me, who brought this matter up, and although I'm sure his name stirs a lot of controversies, Eric von Däniken.
Mm-hmm.
I met Eric von Däniken more or less at the same time I met John West, and Eric von Däniken told me something I'll never forget. He said, you are now the expert, okay, on this matter. So don't be intimidated by experts. And he gave me a book which I cherish, and I've got it somewhere on my shelf here, which I think I told you last time, The Experts Speak. You probably find it on Google. It's written by two journalists in New York, where they list all the experts who got it wrong. You know, it's amazing how people, certainly in the pre-50s, where people took experts' word and that was it. No, there is an argument that was made on the age of the Sphinx. The argument is solid. It's a geological argument. It's using hard science. There is textual arguments. There is the astronomy arguments. Now, we haven't... There hasn't been the smoking gun yet, but we're working towards the smoking gun, or at least lean the issue very much in favor of an older Sphinx. But for Egyptologists to have poo-pooed this arbitrarily, simply because they didn't like it, using their authority, using their position of academic position to try and frighten and intimidate people like West, well, kudos to him, and a lesson to people like me who followed the same route. I felt I've put a good argument here. You know, my argument is solid. I can't bring the smoking gun evidence. I don't think we'll ever have smoking gun evidence on such matters. But the argument is solid, and that's how things go. You know, you start on with the proper theory. It's investigated. People try to falsify it, and let's see what happens. But no, this is not what happened in Egyptology. I'm sorry if I'm ranting about Egyptology again, but there we are. John was the initial sacrificial goat, if you like, that they went for him, and he stood by his guns, and he, you know, that's how I see him, and I took stock from this. And indeed, I remember. Hence, why we were called the Four Horsemen. You know, we joined forces, if you like, because, and we were a very loose kind of force, because, you know, we didn't have an establishment. We didn't have Schock was at Boston University, but we didn't have an institute. You know, we lived in different countries and different continents, but we held on against universities, against, you know, I'm blowing my trumpet at the moment, and John's trumpet, because we're 20, 30 years later. But it needs to be said, and this is what this man deserves. He deserves that immense respect and credit for laying the way of how to deal with what has been termed alternative history. Alternative history may become history, all right? And that's what he started.
One of the things that has always impressed me is his ability to take a stance that is outside of even for people like myself or like Shock that will originally be very consider themselves open-minded, as John Anthony West said to one individual, fine to be an open-minded geologist. And he found one in Dr. Robert Shock. The belief that the Sphinx is over 12,500 years old. If I'm not mistaken, and again, John himself or his family may be able to correct me on this, that he believes that it's possible it could actually be 36,400 years old.
Yes, I'm not against that possibility, mm-hmm. but as I always said, you know, we've have enough trouble with 10,500 BC, so let's take it easy here. it is possible. It's possible, but I think the geology suggests wouldn't go that far. If I'm sure Shock will support me on this, the geology pushes the date to 12th millennium. You know, it's not a very precise dating with geology, but it's around that date. I think to push it that far, I don't think Shock would be ready to go there. But hey, the question is still open. I was so doing a search on the manuscript of my book, and I've put Buddha, and I've just realized that my co-author, Professor Chandra Vikramasinghe, has actually quoted Buddha, but a different quote, and I've got to read you this because I didn't realize he had put this. He says, Buddha's last words to his disciple Ananda exemplify the empiricism of Buddhist philosophy, which I wholeheartedly support. Mm-hmm. That's written by Chandra Vikramasinghe. And the quote is, be lamps unto yourselves. Only rely on yourselves and not on external help. Hold fast to the lamp of truth. Seek refuge only in the truth. Look not for refuge on anyone beside yourself. Yeah, that's very good advice. Let's see if I find mine. Yes, here is mine. The one I was trying to, and that's the quote. There are two mistakes one can make along the road to truth. Not going all the way and not starting. I love that one. Well, John has started it and he went all the way. So the Buddha would have been proud of him.
And everything that's been built up around the search for the true... I'm going to say the true origins, the mysteries of where we as a society came from, previous to 6000 BC, because, well, there is no real written history beyond that point. We have figurines, we have skeletons in the ground, you know, we have rudimentary tools that people have found, but there are many threads to that past, as Graham would say, that we are a species with amnesia. And I cannot ever say it as eloquently as he can, but I do try. And the one thing that he always, and we have mentioned it, is Zeptepi the first time. And one interesting, and I'm going to quote Graham's website, and this is an article that was written... Actually, it's actually by a man with the author name Thunderbird, the first time. And again, this could be, I thought it was actually from Graham, but it could be correct, which is when the gods ruled in their country. They said it was a golden age during which the waters of the abyss had receded. The primordial darkness was banished, and humanity emerging into the light was offered the gifts of civilization. And he goes on to say, they spoke also of intermediaries between gods and men, the Urshu, a category of lesser divinities whose title meant the Watchers. What would be your... Is this something that you have perspective on?
I think I talked about this in our last interview, but in this day and age, or more precisely, in cutting-edge knowledge and science, we have to put many things on the table. 50 years ago, things were very different. We didn't have quantum physics. We knew very little about the cosmos, other than knowing that we were a planetary system and we're inside a galactic, a galaxy, the Milky Way, and we had a rough idea about its size. 50 years on, today, we have to contend with, well, cosmology that has, and astronomy that has given us a completely different view with hard evidence that we're in a cosmos that is much vaster than and much more populated than we would have ever dreamt. The latest is, it was in the Scientific American of June, I think, or several, I'm not sure if Scientific American or Astronomy Today, or, but the last count, due to improving the optical facilities with camera on Hubble telescope, has confirmed that the number of galaxies in the visible universe is not 100 billion, which was already an enormous amount, as previously thought, but 1 trillion. We live in a visible universe that has 1 trillion galaxies, each having an average of 100 billion or 200 billion stars, and with a size that boggles the wildest of imagination, 13.5 billion light years. This is something that, and we're finding within our own galactic system evidence of planetary systems. The latest one is, well, there may be even a later one, because I'm not following the news every day, but the latest was TRAPPIST-1, with a planet with a sun about 49 light years away, practically in our galactic backyard, as they say, with 7 Earth-like planets. They're estimating over 1 billion planets within our galaxy alone. So the odds are way, way, way different of finding life, and probably advanced life, an advanced civilization, outside our own planetary system, even within our own galactic system. So having said this, we must be open to, and then comes quantum mechanics, and comes string theory. And now, and this was, I can assure you, in the Scientific American of last month, where the multiverse is being taken extremely seriously by a majority of scientists today. We live in this kind of context. Everything is possible. And here we are on this little planet, you know, hardly 200,000 years of Homo sapien evolution. And we have Egyptologists telling us with certainty that there was nothing before 3000 BC. Whereas this planet has existed for 4.5 billion years, and anything could have happened, anything at all. And, you know, we were poo-pooed down when we suggested lost civilization and God. They were poo-pooed down when they suggested possible extraterrestrial contact. Well, this is on the table now. It has to be on the table. We have to put it there. And, of course, the book I've written with Chandra Vikramasinghe puts it on the table in a very serious manner. We have to be in the 21st century when we look at the past. You know, we have to move on and look at things the way they have to be looked at, without the fear of ridicule from an establishment that is still thinking in a classical, old-fashioned way. We have anomalies at Giza. We have serious anomalies. We don't know how they build these monuments. We don't know how they move the stones. We don't know why they build them with such perfection. We don't know why they put mathematical constant in their design. We don't know why they build the Sphinx at that time. You know, the Hall of Records. All these things have to be looked at seriously. This is what the horsemen and others should bring more to the forefront. This is what I'm doing with these books, and particularly with the book I've written with Chandra Vikramasinghe. Because now, with having a scientist from within the fold, you know, a very heavyweight scientist, a professor of astrobiology at Cardiff University, who has taught at Cambridge University, who is still a visiting professor at various universities with endless awards in his profession, and him having an open mind to this, an open mind, a serious open mind to this. You know, so what I'm trying to say is that this generation, which started with West, of alternative history, and with the new generation that will follow, the new kids on the block, I can name you a few, but I don't want to do that now. Well, Gary Osborne, for one, and various others that are looking into this mystery.
And it's a very interesting point that you make about that. I'm not sure if you've heard or heard of this book, Humans Are Not From Earth, A Scientific Evaluation of Evidence by Ellis Silver. It's essentially, several years ago, a leading environmentalist and ecologist proposed at least the theory that humans are not, like, we are not actually from here. Not it goes beyond the idea of we were engineered by by a race that came here looking for gold. It's we as human beings.
I don't like this idea at all, to be honest with you. The way I look at it is panspermia. I mean, Chandra in the 70s, Chandra Vikramasinghe with Sir Fred Hoyle proposed a theory that's becoming very, very popular now, mainly because of the evidence, is that life originated in the cosmos long, long, long before even our planetary system was formed. You know, our planetary system is 4.5 billion years old, and that we may, according to this panspermia theory, life originated millions, if not billions of years before. If they're right, and it looks like they are right, then here is the thing that we have to put on the table. We, in 200,000 years, have moved from being in caves to putting people on the moon, and me talking to you with a microphone across continents, and seeing each other on Skype. You know, and soon we'll have people, or we'll certainly have probes on Mars, and probably a manned expedition on Mars. We've taken that in just 200,000 years. Imagine what we'll be able to do if we don't blow ourselves up in another 200 years, in another 1,000 years, in another 100,000 years. So what if, and the what if is very, very, very much on the table, there is civilizations out there that are a couple of centuries ahead of us, 2 centuries, 1,000 years, 1 billion years ahead of us. Their technology, their science would be totally unthinkable to us. It would be even beyond science fiction. This is on the table. You know, no matter how skeptical people want to be, it is on the table. It is something that has to be discussed, and it is discussed among the scientific community, with astrophysicists, with the astrobiologists. It is discussed. It's common discussion. Not with our friends, the Egyptologists. Not with our friendly archaeologists. They are behind the times. Now, I'm not saying that every single ancient monument on this planet has something to do with a possible extraterrestrial contact. But we have a prime monument, the Great Pyramid of Giza. It is there. It has baffled generations, no matter what Egyptologists say, in its construction, in its design, in its astronomy. And we haven't been able to explain it properly. Even today, with hundreds and hundreds of experts looking at it. So this is what I'm saying, and I've been saying this for quite a long time, and this is what I'm saying in a very strong way in this book that I'll be bringing out with Vikramasinghe in December. We have to open the discussion and bring it back to where it should be, on the site itself. We have to be allowed to go and do research there. You know the story about the Sphinx. I mean, it's ridiculous that with all the evidence that has been put forward by Robert Schork and later by another expedition, the Droshor Jehoda expedition in 96, where there's overwhelming radar and scintigraphic evidence that there might be a chamber under the Sphinx.
And that
Egyptologists are refusing to allow further exploration. When the scientific tools are there, that will not harm in any way the site. You know, the door inside the Great Pyramid that was discovered by Rudolf Ganzberg in 93. We're still waiting to see what's behind those doors. You know, rather than hearing the constant, you know, it's nonsense and arbitrary arguments. No, these are the matters that have to be brought back on the site itself. So, yeah, sorry, yeah, 15 minutes.
I was trying to do it all TV-like. And
I warned you. I'm one of those people who gets warmed up and
we can always go a little longer. I know that we were going to have a discussion, which is probably going to be me talking, and I like the sound of your voice much better. So we can always cut into that part and be able to gain a little more knowledge and perspective from you. But you're discussing the concept of shock, and I know that back in February when we did our first fundraiser for John, and he described the absolutely horrendous conditions in his own academic community, like not necessarily from the geologist community, because a lot of them, if not a majority of them, backed him up on his assertions of the weather erosion and the water erosion on the Sphinx. With regards to the book from Ellis Silver, it is a very radical theory, and I did a fair amount of research into Ellis Silver to try and get them on the Den of Lore. And one very interesting thing that I found out was the person doesn't exist.
Who?
Ellis Silver. And I'll send you the information once we get offline.
You mean the author doesn't exist?
Well, they exist, but this is a nom de plume. And I actually tracked down the person who published the book, and I asked, okay, well, what is the situation? And they are Ellis Silver is a nom de plume, and the person is a very well-known, somebody you would see on TV, or they would be brought on CNN, you know, news programs as an actual expert. Extremely, extremely, extremely well-known. If even their voice could give them away. And this is something that they actually believe is a possibility, and they've had to go through such lengths to disguise their identity, to be able to bring this notion out in the world so people can at least chew on it, or at least consider it. And this for them is a theory. They don't know if it's 100% correct. They said, this is what I think is possible, and this is the information behind it. But if they're known, their entire career that they've built up over many, many, you know, decades would have been completely destroyed. And it's a shame, because if we're supposed to try and gain increased knowledge and understanding through collaboration and discussion and distillation of ideas and looking at a problem or a concept and saying, okay, well, this is a theory. Does it work? Yes, great. Move on to the next one. Does it not? Okay, let's put it aside for now and go on to the next one. But we as a society have been trained to not do this, to be able to oppose new ideas especially as an example in Egyptology. And I'm very thankful that individuals such as yourself or John Anthony West, Robert Schock, John Major Jenkins, who have been so courageous to say, this is a possibility, and even though it may not be true, we need to talk about this. And you...
Okay, sorry, I interrupted. Let me quote you, since we're doing quotes, you know. Professor of Philosophy and Computer Science at the University of Oxford, Peter Millikan, he's quite a heavyweight, huh? He said this, and I'm quoting it in the book, and that's what he says. It's healthy to have some crazy ideas. You don't want to censor ideas according to whether they seem sensible or not, because sometimes important new advances would seem crazy to start with. You never know when good ideas may come from thinking outside the box. I mean, that's what it's about. And I'm surprised that, you see, the problem is peer pressure. Peer pressure. Thank goodness John was outside this peer ethos. And so was I. And so was Graham. And Shock, who was within the academic world, even more kudos to him, because he went for it. You know, you have to go for it. And I think this business about pseudonyms and nom de plume and all this is sad.
Yes.
They should have come out strongly. Look, the most crazy, I mean, Galileo was branded crazy. Copernicus was branded crazy. The founding fathers of quantum mechanics was crazy. I mean, 100 years ago, when you said that there would be landing on the moon, people said you were crazy. I mean, you know, the craziest ideas have proved to be correct. Well, I'm not saying every crazy idea. I'm saying crazy idea by intelligent people who, I think the word crazy isn't correct, who are thinking outside the box and come up with something that goes completely against the grain, completely against the current, but will be right at the end. So, look, I'm going to lay my reputation here. The book will be out anyway. And I'm very, very open now to the possibility of an extraterrestrial contact. I'm extremely open, and there is a lot of reasons that I have taken into account that makes me say this. All right? The truth is that it's wrong to say we have hard evidence. We do not have hard evidence. We really do not have hard evidence. What we have is anomalies that need to be investigated. And that's the right way to approach this. And if these anomalies bring out the evidence, then yes. And if they don't, well, they don't. But this is how this matter has to be approached. And I don't have to put a nom de plume to do this. I believe that any sensible, scientifically minded, open-minded person will not see a problem with this at all. It is only those who have a vested interest in maintaining a status quo. You know, Egyptologists have established what Egyptian civilization is, when it has started, how it has started, and they want to stick on this no matter what. Well, that's not science. Science changes things. You know, if we apply their way of thinking, we'd still be on a flat Earth, you get my point, all right?
Of course. It's I see this as an age of new enlightenment and new ideas. Even for myself, I started with being extremely open-minded and saying, okay, well, you know, the Anunnaki theory was 100%, you know, like, was correct. And, you know, the idea of Sitchin was 100% correct. And I went from there to being very, I'm going to say, close-minded to a certain extent. Where it'd be
skeptical,
like...
Skeptical is the right word.
Very, okay, sorry, being skeptical more than open-minded. And it was only in the last, after years of having that very open-mindedness, to several months of skepticism, to going back the other way again in kind of an equal amount of time in the last 3 or 4 months.
I'll put it to you in one phrase. I mean, somebody said, and I'm trying to remember again who said it, it's okay to have an open mind. Mm-hmm. It's not okay to have your brains drop out. All right? So there is things that one should have an open mind. Mm-hmm. There are other things that, I'm sorry, I'm not going to have my brains drop out so that you think I'm cool and I'm open-minded. So, yes, skepticism is a must in investigation. You start with being skeptical, but not close-minded. I'm skeptical because what you're proposing is, what somebody's proposing is very radical. So I look at the evidence. I look at what is the arguments. Take it further. And then slowly, the skepticism converts itself into a proper investigation. But you start with skepticism. you know, people were gullible because somebody said it and that's it. No, it doesn't work like this for me. And I expect to be people to be skeptical about what I say and what I've done. They were. And I was quite happy with this. I was quite happy that it starts with skepticism. I said the three pyramids of Giza look like the three stars of Orion's belt. Here is the evidence. There is a shaft in the Great Pyramid pointing to Orion's belt. Here are the pyramid texts and so forth. But skepticism started properly. But then it became arbitrary. This is what was wrong with Egyptology. They didn't like it. Well, truth isn't something that has to please Egyptologists or anybody else. Truth is truth. You know, and if they didn't like it, well, that was too bad. And unfortunately, that's the position they took. And how do you, they would stop a movement like this, like John West's Age of the Sphinx and the correlation theory, mm-hmm. is they tried to... they first tried to sort of joking and say this is a lot of rubbish, it didn't work, so they went to the next step and saying we were charlatans, we were amateurs, but it didn't quite work, and then started the nasty stuff. It got to the point where John West, well, in the early days, was being accused of being a Zionist spy. I was accused of, you can't believe what I was accused of. But, so this was all wrong coming from this profession, and this got us more obstinate. And this, by the way, got a lot of scientists on our side, because scientists were shocked by this. I can tell you, when Hancock and I brought out the message of the Sphinx, and Hancock wrote The Fingerprints of the Gods, we were ostracized on a television program very badly. I mean, I was accused of putting maps upside down and all this. Well, it backfired, because that's not the way to deal with new ideas. It's not the way at all, and that's when I got the support. But by the way, that's how I met all these wonderful people like Chandra Vikramasinghe and Mary Brooke and various others, because they came to my support. They said, well, look, we may not agree with you, but that's not the way that a profession should behave. This is all wrong. And this is unfortunately what... when I say Egyptology, I don't want to put all Egyptologists in one basket. Unfortunately, it was a gang of Egyptologists that held the floor, if you like. And I'm speaking about Dr. Zahi Hawass, I'm speaking about Mark Lehner, I'm speaking even of Vivian Davis, the British Museum, who, people can read it in the book. I mean, I was amazed at the way that I was being treated. I mean, I was a bona fide higher diploma engineer. I came from a very good trade. And there he was suggesting that I was some sort of lunatic. You know, this was all wrong. I couldn't understand this patronizing behavior. You know, so to me, this is where Egyptology has, in a way, let down itself. And this is, I hope the new generation of Egyptologists will not do that. Will look at ideas, even if they come from the outside. And this idea about the age of the Sphinx is one that they have to look at. And it's being shoved down their throat at the moment, really badly, you know, because it is based on two very heavy sciences. Geology is not wild speculation. Astronomy is not wild speculation. And the two sciences converge to give us an older Sphinx. They have to look at it, no matter what, and they will. And if it's not this generation, it'll be the next one, but they will. You got me going there, Chris.
you're like me in the fact that I love a good rant, and I love to be able to express exactly how you feel, and being honest about your...
I'm 69 years old. I'm not going to hold my punches now.
Oh, I'm 34, and I'm just getting to that point as well, and it's getting me a little bit of trouble, but you know what? That's life. You only live once.
They can't hang me twice, you know? I'm okay. I'm used to being hanged. No. I mean, we need to bring this matter properly out. We have. We've been doing it for the last 25 years, but this is a time to bring it out, mainly because of John West. You know, here is a man who is in a, you know, who's not well. He is fighting for his life. And he deserves this kind of attention. And he deserves to hear at least one Egyptologist, for God's sake, one Egyptologist to say, we are going to look into this matter. All right? That's my last message, loud and clear, to whoever Egyptologist is listening. One of you, come out. Say you're going to look into this properly. All right?
That is,
put me on the air on this one.
And I'm going to close up the segment with that, because I don't think, like, that's the perfect cap, the perfect capstone that will eventually be lost somewhere and hopefully refound in the future to this segment.
Excellent. Do that.
to be able to close, I would like to at least get your perspective. What is the way forward? How do you see the next era of researchers building off of this work?
Well, two things. I think that Egyptologists have to be a bit more democratic. I mean, Egyptology isn't just for Egyptologists. I mean, take the Giza Necropolis. It requires construction. Well, they have there. I mean, I don't want to be too hard on them. There has been other professions involved, but they have been very, very, very resistant to new theories that are solidly built, and they've been very, very resistant to allowing others to come and investigate properly on the site. So this has to change. Egyptology has to democratize itself a bit. I hope that the new generation will do that. The other thing is that outsiders, you don't have to be a PhD qualified Egyptologist or archaeologist to be allowed to come up with new ideas. I mean, that's one of the things Chandra, I respect him very much. I mean, he actually wrote to the Times, if I'm not mistaken, or certainly in the early days when I was being attacked. He said this: it's very wrong for a profession, an academic profession, to think that new ideas cannot come from somebody outside, from what they call the amateur. You know, most of the good ideas in this world have come from so-called amateurs. So yeah, the way forward is this. I mean, let's remove all this political nonsense that has prevailed and dominated Egyptology for the last 30 years, and let the new generation bring in new ideas, new ways to look at this. There is a whole lot of new science that can be applied there. Mm-hmm. If, well, hey, the muon. Project that was going on a year ago. We have heard nothing about this, by the way. You know, the muon scanners of the pyramid. It started with a lot of publicity and then it died down. You know what? It's the same old story. You know, a proper scientific investigation starts, then gets the politics and how was said, you know, it doesn't, you know, this and that and that. And then they argue about who's going to publish first, and they're arguing about who has the right to publish. And not, and it gets lost into this verbiage of political archaeology. You know, this has to stop. This has to stop. I've battled against this for the last 30 years, and this is my message. This is the way forward. You know, hey, the Giza Necropolis is a legacy of the past to everybody who has a legitimate investigation to do. I'm not saying every Tom, Dick, and Harry can go there and dig, but Schock had a legitimate right to go there. West had a legitimate right. Rudolf Ganterbrück, who has been rudely ostracized to such a point where he doesn't want to even hear about the Giza Necropolis. This man gave 10 years of his life to build robotic machines, to explore the pyramid. He's found a door. He has excited the world with new ideas that there may be something inside the Great Pyramid. And look what they've done to him. They took him to court, you know, with all this nonsense. So, you know, again, I'm ranting, but the public has to be aware of this. The public has to be aware of this, and Egyptologists have to open their doors and let some fresh air come in, all right?
You know, and that's you and I are in agreement on that. And I'm very confident that many, many others out there are the same. Again, just to hold on the line while we finish up this particular segment, and I will talk to you just off air for a few moments. Ladies and gentlemen, please do stick around. We have tons more to come. Presentations from Gary A. David, Randall Carlson, Aaron Cheek, Edward Nightingale. We have so much more on this program for you. Thank you very much for your support and for being with us this morning and this afternoon. Back to the studio.